Morning.
So I'm not going to use the microphone. I think I don't like to do that. So can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, great. So hey everyone, Mark Mazur. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for Entertainment Partners. So in this session, this is meant to be a technical session. So hopefully, not everyone's going to leave here in a moment. But the idea is to do a little deeper dive in what we do at ET to protect data. And the reason I wanted to do a technical session this time, or just in general, was we want to talk about what we're actually doing, and hopefully it gets out some thoughts in the industry as well. And I'm not going to do the talking. I brought practitioners. These are guys on my team, the security team here, that actually do the work and do this every day. So it's not me, the politician CISO kind of guy. It's going to be the actual practitioners, and I thought that would be a whole lot more value. But just a couple setup discussions. So about me, I've been a CISO for over 20 years in multiple companies. Means I pretend I know what I'm doing. But beyond that. So when we're thinking about our security model, one of the things I've learned over the years is, particularly in the security world, there's tons of things going on. All kinds of threats and risks and attacks and everything else. But what's really important? The number one most important thing is the foundational model, right? You gotta get the basics right. There's advanced capabilities, advanced threat dynamics, and everything else that goes on in the world of security. But if you don't have the foundations, the basics done, you're not doing it right. So when we think about security, we want to think about it in a very smart, thoughtful way. And this is meant to be give you a little posture, a little pondering kind of question, right? What's the value of that guy locking the car to the pole? And that's how we need to think, right? Tons of tools and technologies. It's 2018. There's tons of things you can go buy. And a lot of it is, vaporware, or not necessarily all there as a solution. Or maybe it solves a little bit of a problem, but you've got to think about the bigger problem. So when we're thinking about security at EP, we're thinking about it from that perspective, because we don't want to have this problem. So we're going to cover several things in this discussion. Hopefully it's interactive. Please do. Once again, the practitioners are here. If you want to drill them and get in the weeds, feel free to do so. We're going to talk about three core areas that we think is important for protecting data. One is encryption. Everybody knows what encryption means and what it does, but how do you do it at an enterprise in a big volume way? How do you do it from a policy perspective? How do you do it from an integration perspective? It is not simple. Anybody says you just deploy a tool and you got encryption is wrong. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about one of the key concerns in IT world is protecting administrative privileges. So we give the keys to the kingdom to our IT folks. Maybe sometimes it's outsourced or it's internal. But we give them these big, have every access you want because you got to do your job. But how do you protect about that? So we've got some thoughts around that. But it's not just a solution, but how we actually integrate it is important. And then third, and it's one of the key components of our security program, is integrating and testing security in the development lifecycle. So this is not just pen test after somebody built a product and you find a bunch of holes and you got to go back to it and say, go fix the holes, and this recursive process that never ends. We've integrated security and testing into the lifecycle itself, and we're going to actually tell you how we do that. And we hopefully get some value out of that. That's all I'm going to say. So the politician's going to go away. I'm going to hand it over to Frank.
Hey, everyone.
Thank you, Martin. So encryption. So don't everybody on at once, and if you're having trouble sleeping, buy a book on encryption and read it. Hopefully this is not going to be that boring. So who am I? I'm the Director of Information Assurance for EP. My name's Frank. I've been there 1.5 years now. Have roughly 10 years of experience in this industry specific, and about 20 years in information technology, so that makes me older. This graphic you'll see here, is there's a reason behind it. Not only does it make me old, but it kind of represents where we've come from a secure your data perspective. So there's various types of encryption. In the old days, in the old floppies, full disk was really the only thing around. So starting out at the top, you have the main way of securing the data from a storage perspective was really locking it up, putting it in behind a closet, right? Putting a key, that was how you secured it. There wasn't really encryption back then. As media progressed into hard drives and CD-ROM and DVD, now you get into where encryption started to be present, where you had tools that would encrypt that drive. And it's kind of digital key type representation. And as it's progressed now into the cloud, small, you know, portable, easily transported type of thing, we really got to move to a shield model. It's got to be more than just the encryption at this point. And that's kind of where we took that approach. We said, well, what can we do outside of full disk, outside of some of the native stuff that's in the tool? And what we really said is we want to do volume file level encryption, which gives us a much broader protection against the data and using and tying that into access control. And that's the key part about how we took this approach. Is it's not just the encryption. We actually are applying policy to it, like a firewall. So we're applying ACLs to the encryption that say only certain things that can do decryption and use this particular data type. Mm-hmm. So what is the value of performing the encryption at rest using that type of approach? And what we want to do is we want to protect all data. So it's structured, unstructured, temp files, log files. Log files are a huge risk. A lot of the log files in clear text have all kinds of data in them, passwords, you name it. And that is a big risk, and a lot of people ignore it. They do not pay attention to that. So we want to make sure we capture it all. Native TD is going to get there, right? Native TD will apply encryption at the field level inside of the database. You're not going to get that other information back up to the database, log files, etc. We want to protect against multiple attack type scenarios. So compromised credentials, that one, that's the big one. Equifax is a great example. They got in with, through a particular type of exploit. They got some credentials, service accounts, sitting on some, probably a server in a log file potentially somewhere, and they laterally moved. And after that, it was game over for them. And that's what we wanted to focus on. That's what we're protecting against. And then there's also now particularly a big focus on the regulatory and compliance side. So a lot of data privacy stuff wants you to encrypt, right? And they don't necessarily specify how. They don't say, hey, you need to do more than just encrypt, but we took that approach, so we want to make sure we're protected. So what we said was dedicated technology solution versus native TD. We really spent a lot of time in that comparison. And we wanted to find out if we just did native TD across the board, what was the impact to us? And we noticed when we were doing that comparison, particularly against a dedicated type of solution, was that native TD was going to be really expensive. And it was going to require a lot of man hours to implement across the board. You get standardized versions of SQL, for example. And you don't get all the other benefits that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Performance was a big one as well. I'll explain that a little bit more to get more into this. But that granular control is really what we're looking for, which you just don't get with a native TD type solution. Role-based access, also very key and critical for us. And the other aspect that a lot of people forget about when they do encryption is key management. Another thing that gets very much ignored. We'll go and apply encryption like a native TD, and they'll forget that they have to manage those keys somehow and protect those keys. And again, people just apply it, they said they do it, but all their keys are somewhere where somebody can get to really easily. And so it's almost pointless to do. So simple or simpler, since far as preferred to it's not simple. What we were trying to find was a way that was least impactful to our applications as it stood today with varying types of backends, DB2, SQL, you name it. So we were looking to do that, and when we were trying to figure out, applying encryption simply is really counterintuitive. It really is, if you think about it. And so we were trying to find a tool and a solution that would help with that. So we said ease of deployment, we wanted minimal infrastructure and software changes. That was, again, huge for us. We were looking for a solution that could make that easier. Administrative overhead, a lot of people forget about this too. It's when we get inside of key management and things of that nature. There's a day-to-day management component to it. So you want something you can put in place and will ease the things like key management. And separate solution not required. That's really what we were also looking at. We didn't want to go build a whole key management infrastructure for the encryption we were going to do. And the solution we picked actually provides built-in encryption. So usability, again, platform agnostic, that was a big focus for us. We have MS SQL, Postgres, DB2 in our environments. We want to make sure we can protect them with a single type of solution. Access controls that are available for system level users groups, LDAP, Active Directory, containers, that's a big one too. And those access controls, again, let us basically identify what process and procedures are normal and what's not. So the solution allows you to basically apply the encryption in a monitor-only mode, and it will actually detect, all these different things, and then you can write rules based on that information. The other one that's really interesting and people forget about as well is your IT admins. So So your IT admin generally have root, you know, domain admin, whatever you think about. How do you protect the data against them? Right? Because it's not them that necessarily are going to be the bad guys. But when their credentials are lost or compromised, they're in. And once they're in, they now have access to everything. This solution actually protects against that. So you can have a person on a DB2 platform, Linux platform, with this solution, full root access, and it prohibits them from getting to the data. So if they try to grab the data and pull it off, it's unusable, completely unusable. And it has, of course, industry standards with AES, 256 encryption, blah, 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 that's right, it's boring. But the one key thing we found with this solution in particular was it is agent-based, but the agent relies on the hardware that's built into systems nowadays. So there's a lot of, in the chipsets and things that are built in, there's encryption technologies. And this solution actually takes advantage of it. The interesting thing was, when we deployed this, we did full dev UAT QA testing across the board. But probably the most interesting aspect of deploying this particular solution was that we actually increased performance on all our systems. So we deployed this, and because we deployed it in an agent-based fashion and removed native TD, which is a performance hit, we actually saw a spike in performance when we applied this to our system. So that was huge for us. And of course, flexible and scalable, we really wanted that. We wanted, with the move to the cloud and move, you know, think the containerization, we had to be able to cover all those things in the solution. We didn't want 10 different tools trying to do it across the board, because inevitably, if you do too many tools, too many people managing it, you're going to forget something or miss something. This is the technical side of it. Kind of gives a picture of how it is. It's an appliance-based. You can run an AJA. And that appliance, the vehicle they call the DSM, is applying that encryption, it's managing the keys. You can do two-factor authentication for your people who administrate it. Again, policy-based, you can tie it to AD. Ton of flexibility in how you deploy the solution. So, centralized key management, really important for us. We wanted a solution, ideally, too, that could automate some of that. Key rotation, destruction of keys, escrow, etc. Separation of duties, we talked a bit about that. But we can segment the key ownership and management by role. So in the tool, you can define roles for specific people who can do what. And that's really important, because you can basically write, you know, a rule that just says, this person can only access the data, run a particular tool set, or whatever they need for your business process. And if they try to do anything else, they can. Automating logging is something you want to make sure you cover in any tool. You want to make sure that out of this, there's a good incident response process, because when you find out what's normal, what's not normal, when something not normal occurs, you need to be able to handle that. You need to understand what to do. High availability, of course, is key. The solution is pretty interesting. You can deploy HA in one location. You can have like a secondary unit off in the DR site. In case something happens, it'll replicate across. Multi-tenant data isolation. So again, we wanted to make sure we could focus on it. I think the key thing to take from that particular one is we're actually able to, with the solution, encrypt particular types of data and folders by studio, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So we can actually have separate keys, which is really important because with the SSL encryption. And you can actually also do kind of like a bring your own key type solution. So if you apply encryption to a particular folder set that has a particular client's data, if you have a key dedicated to that, if they wanted to manage their own key, this solution matches that.
That's it from my perspective.
Cool.
All right. Hey, everyone. So I'm going to cover Clearview's identity management.
Right.
How we do an EP.
Right.
So I'm Steve Lamb. I'm a senior information assurance architect there at EP. I've been here 2 years, 8 years of information security, 10 years in IT. What is privileged identity management, right? So it provides secure access to your critical assets within your organizations in a manageable way, where you can manage these type of identities, right? You got your domain admins, right? These are the five type of users, right? You got privileged, powerful, and standard users, right? So how we do it here, we're controlling these domain admins and these infrastructure admins and database admins through our program, right? And then our application admins, right? You got application admins like for Salesforce or social media accounts, right? And all these other third-party applications that, you don't even know how they're accessing these admin portals, right? And then you got the application super users, right? maybe have delegated rights almost to admin, so we can try and control that, those identities within our program and our solution. And then we got the standard users that are actually using it. So those are different types, how we broke it down. So what's the value of performing, developing your privileged identity management program, right? It's really cyber protection, cyber threat protection, right? So, once hackers are getting into your network, they're going to look for, privileged accounts or privileged identities to pivot from there and laterally move and to target the specific system that has the data that they want, right? And then we're going to misuse it, going to leak it on the dark net and, paste it and whatnot. And then that spuns up a whole slew of problems from the governance standpoint from, access, right? And also it ensures compliance around there. So you got your audits, right? You got GDPR compliance requirements, you got ISO, you got PCI, HIPAA, all these type of regulatory compliance, right? They're going to ask you, what are you doing to protect your privileged identities, right? If you don't have no solution in place, you're going to fail those audits and those regulatory guidelines. And then you want to manage these risks, right? In a way where, how do you know if an IT admin is not leaking data out or sharing the credentials with another third party or selling the credentials to in an hour, or even an hour for, I don't know, some sort of amount of Bitcoin, right? So how do you manage this? How do you keep track of this, right? You want to manage this risk. And also data loss protection, right? These identities have super privileges that allows you to exfiltrate data, right? And hackers are in the network for a couple months before they do anything, before even the security teams to detect it, right? So how do you manage these type of abnormal behaviors that will go unseen for a couple months, right? And then you want to enable the business, right? That's a crucial factor for us. We want to enable the business to perform business, right? You don't want to prohibit them. So we got third party contractors, vendors, right? You got product management, business, leaders that are trying to access and perform the day-to-day business functions to grow a company. And also vendors coming in to help develop your solutions, right? Or even help support the solutions, right? If you have offshore contractors, right, to help manage these types of systems within your environment, how you control that. Right. So when we analyze our landscape, right, and then the past history of breaches, right? If you took all these breaches, they get Anthem, eBay, Target, JP Morgan, Home Depot. All the common elements that how they got breached is through a privileged identity, right? So, either Target, for example, right, they outsource their HVAC, process, right, management to a third party, right? The hackers infiltrated the third party and got the credentials that have access to Target systems, right? And from there, they just pivot from there to stay, try to be quiet, right, basically, and take the time to get to know their environment. After that, then they got pivoted, and then they just executed to infiltrate the credit card data, right? And how do you protect against that? So all these companies that got breached, this common theme, right, is to protect their privileged identity, right? So how we approached it, these are some of the key areas that how EPE approached for developing a program around protecting identity. So password vaulting, right? You want a hard and secure place to vault your passwords, right? That encrypt that rest with AES-256. So if they say an attacker compromises identities, it's encrypted. They won't be able to use the password. And then also protection of administrative privileges, portals. Third-party applications, and also supporting hybrid environments, right? We have so much dynamic IT environments out there right now. You got public cloud, you got your third-party vendors, and all these different legacy environments, or how you protect that, right? And then you want to do some session monitoring. So whenever these high privileged accounts are accessing these critical assets, we are actually having a session recording of it. Right, there's actually a DVR playback where we can actually view and see what they're clicking, what they're typing, into all that level, right? So So really going having that, that capability to go back and to post-analyze those type of events, you know, in case, let's say if there's an incident, we can go back in time, right, narrow that down into a time-specific area and narrow down and look at the session, what's happening, or what happened during that time. And we do have some forensic analysis from that perspective and data from there from other log collection sources. And also, you know, policy-driven violations. So let's say if a user's typing, suiting up the root, right? We're basically blacklisting that, and then you get an alert. Like, why is this user trying to get, you know, public privileges, right? So, you know, we kick up that, we trigger that alert, and, you know, we'll go ahead and, you know, go ahead and go through our process to investigate. So hybrid environments, virtual, cloud, physical environments, you know, how do you discover these type of dynamic resources and identities that are basically being spun up or created? Right? So you want to have an automated discovery way of how to discover these type of resources and identities that are basically being created on a fly. And then feeding into like a SIM with user behavior analytics solution, right? So what's abnormal, right? You want to have a baseline, and all, you know, once you have the baseline, then we can see what's abnormal with these identities, right? Are they accessing it from here, and then at the same time accessing from China, right? You know, how you correlate that, right? And how you trigger that, how you develop these IOC, the indicators or compromises to see if this account is being used somewhere else during the same time. Or if a business user is like, hey, I'm not in China, you know, I'm here in Burbank. So it's those type of use cases where we develop the program around, where it really drives value, right? And simpler implementation upgrade, right? You want a solution that is very simple to implement, right? And that's the approach we took. Something that's simple and also upgrade. So upgrading these type of systems can take, you know, months, right? If you want to go to the newest version or even implement, it'll take months, right? With our solution that we chosen, we basically deployed it within a week and upgraded it within a matter of minutes. Right? So that's literally how fast we can basically develop the program. And then administrative overhead, right? If you have a solution that you need to spin up 10 Windows boxes to manage this type of solution, how are you going to administer that? I mean, one person administering that whole type of environment, it'll be hard, difficult. And then if something's break and you know, you don't know where to start looking at, we have like 10 Windows systems, right? And then minimal infrastructure changes, right? You don't want to really impact the environment. So, you know, that's another key area where we basically decided on. So some technical details, these are some. There's host new things, so yeah, so you're controlling these crypto identities, right? Hardened appliance. We have a hardened appliance, right? It's FIPS compliant, and it's very controlling these identities. And how is it controlling? It's basically so we're restoring these identities, and whoever wants our RDP or SSH access or portals, admin portals to, you know, Salesforce, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, will have to go through this appliance solution, right? And once they do, they don't even know the credentials. So we tie the credentials in and it rotates, right? The password is being rotated every 24 hours. That's how we have it set up. So they already know these credentials. They just hit like a button. It'll just launch them into whatever they need access to. So yeah, that's really critical. You know, first, you know, that really eliminates, you know, the password being known and being stored on like Excel or whatever, you know, whatever storage you want to store your identities on. And then single sign-on, right? So once they click it, they'll just automatically single sign-on on. They don't even know the password. And that's very, very valuable from that perspective. And also monitoring audit, right? And recording these sessions and allowing those to respond, right? We don't have the logs or warning or these type of alerts. We won't be able to respond within our incident response process that has these type of video recording sessions. Also tamper evident, right? It's encrypted at rest too. So you can't just exploit that session recording and try to replay it back without, you know, having our solution, right? And then high availability, right? So since now, you know, this solution is very critical to how we manage business, we got to be sure that it's highly available for our IT administrator to help, you know, run the business, right? So we got to make sure that this is up and running 24/7, and if there's not, then we got to make sure we respond to it as soon as possible, get it back up and running. So, you know, we have, so that's another from that perspective. And then this is just a graphical interface here. Not graphical interface, but a graphical image of how a user would basically access these hybrid environments. So.
Question over here.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in. So, is there any responsibility as a part of the actual user beneath the administrator task? Have you removed all possibility for their doing something nefarious or sinister? Have you removed all opportunity for them to be irresponsible and allow user identification to fall into the wrong hands?
So all would be tough, but the reality is nobody has direct access to these systems. So we've taken access across the enterprise away from direct access, and they have to go through the process. And the process, A, number one, is requesting access. So if I'm an administrator, I need to go do my job on these Windows servers. I'm going to go through a process that's completely logged and managed. It's a change management process. Then it's integrated into the tool, so they'll never actually know the credentials. So if their endpoint's compromised, if they're up to no good, and they're going to sell the credentials, so the scope of the window of opportunity is really, really low, and we'll absolutely know. Because once again, as Stephen mentioned, we're capturing everything they're doing. We're actually keylogging everything they're doing and video scraping everything they're doing, so we can replay. And we do. We replay it mostly for operational reasons, but if there's a security incident, we can actually replay the end-to-end activity.
Is it stored as was, or is it?
It's stored as a video. It's stored on a secure server outside of anybody's access. Only the security team has access to it, and it's actually click play and watch a video of them doing it.
Plug, we're going to run out of time, so let me get Terry, and then we'll jump back
to questions. I'll try to squeeze this in. So I'm going to talk a little bit about static application security testing and how we added one of these initiatives to our AppSec program. Right? So application security is a big thing that we need to get in front of. So my name is Terry Barr. I'm one of the application security architects at Entertainment Partners. I've been a developer for 25 years, so I've had the privilege of working at some of these larger companies, Symantec, HP. I've worked for a bunch of .coms. I work for some three-letter government agencies for other things that we can't really talk about. But the reason I bring this up is I have kind of a breadth of experience. You notice at the bottom, I started my career in Quarterdeck. Quarterdeck is a Santa Monica software company. That's a DOS app. Most people don't know what DOS apps are. So this is for the millennials. This is for me, right? So that's me. So I've been able to do window applications, web apps, e-commerce, mobile. I did mobile for 13 years. This slide's a little overpowered, but basically what I want to talk about is SAST. SAST is static application security testing. So why did we pick SAST and not DAST, AST, RAST, all these different acronyms? So basically one of the things we like about SAST is it's static, right? It scans your source code, right? So you don't have to build a binary, you don't have to build DLLs, you don't have to build executables. It'll scan your source code. So now that we're moving towards an agile world, we could start scanning in your very first sprint, right? We don't have to wait till you start developing and product pieces together. So that's why we chose SAST. AST and RAST are newer technologies that are not quite mature for where we want it to be. Plus SAST allows us to fit it in our CI/CD pipeline. What do you want to look at in terms of SAST? SAST does white box testing. Most people are familiar with QA, quality assurance. They do black box testing, right? They push a bunch of buttons, you know, and check things from the outside. White box testing basically looks at the application from the inside out, right? And so it looks at the source code level. And it takes all the permutations of all the different data flows and looks at all the different things looking for security vulnerabilities, right? And that's what we want to do, is secure our code for not only our products, for our customers. The big thing you'll get with SAST is false positive, right? That's the biggest knock. If you look at Gartner, right? Gartner, these are a bunch of the Gartner vendors, right? That are at the top right quadrant. But there's like 39% are false positives, right? And so me being a developer, I don't want another tool you add to my workflow that's going to increase my frustration, right? This is a false positive. I shouldn't have to deal with this type of security vulnerability. Why are you giving it to me? So that's one thing you will have to challenge, but I'll show you how we kind of got around that. And when choosing a tool, we looked at open source, right? Findbugs on the right is a very good open source tool, SonarQube as well. We look at different language support, right? So you have to look at what is your organization building your code in, right? Is it C++, is it Java, is it .NET, right? Is it React, is it Angular, all the different JavaScript frameworks. So your tool has to support those technologies, otherwise they're not going to help you. Policies, does it support some of these, you know, OAuth, SANS, TOP 20, PCI, HIPAA, all those types of things. Those are kind of canned policies you could define in the tool. We actually define our own, but these are out of the box. Open queries, I think this is probably the biggest seller of why we chose a certain vendor, is we didn't want to buy a solution that was canned, right? You get what it gives you, and you can't extend it, right? And as we mature our AppSec program, we want to be able to extend that. Speed, of course, full incremental scans. Some vendors only do full scans, right? And we have some apps, 11 million lines of code. Some are down to, 7,500 lines of code, right? 11 million lines of code takes about 13 hours to scan. So speed's a really big thing. Pipeline integrations, Jira, Jenkins, those types of things. Third-party libraries, I'll talk a little bit in a bit, but this is a big thing, right? I just recently built a Node.js React app, right? I brought in 50 modules in NPM, and it brought in 1,500 dependencies. Think about how you're going to audit 1,500 open source applications that you just pulled into your application. Well, you better have a tool like this. So, anyways, so what has this done for EP, right? First and foremost, when I first was looking at this, we need to change awareness, right? We need to get everybody aware. But then I thought, you know what? Security awareness is not enough, right? We have to change the culture, right? Everybody's job is security. It's not just the AppSec team. Right, just not information, sure, it's everybody. And so we need to try to change this culture of how do we get everybody thinking about security in the agile process at the beginning and not necessarily at the end. And it needs to be shifted left. So what I mean by shifted left, right? Today, in a traditional sense, developers churn out code, QA test it, PEs deploy it, everybody's happy, then what do? We do a pen test at the end every 6 months. That's not good enough. We need to shift left. We need to get AppSec involved in the application design phase so we can flush out those security vulnerabilities. So what was our approach? So we decided on a tool. So how did we decide on a tool? We basically did a bake-off, right? We took a sample of our applications. We took a Java app, C++ app, .NET app, JavaScript app. And we put every vendor through the paces, right? We wanted to see, how good does it do, right? What are your false positives? How good is it at finding true vulnerabilities? You've probably heard of OWASP. They use a framework called WebGoat. WebGoat is kind of a reference application that has a whole bunch of security vulnerabilities in it. These vendors know that, and they kind of curve fit their application to make it look better than it is. So we wanted to do our own bake-off. So we did that. And once we've solidified on a tool, now we have to start implementing in our organization. So what did we do? We have to go find all of our code. We had like 23 code repositories. Right, that's in a variety of different technologies. So, you know, I have to create service account, right? Read-only service account to go get, you know, the ability to scan this type of source code. Then we have to define the policies. This is a big part. Originally, I thought, hey, why don't we scan the world, right? High, medium, lows, put a stake in the ground. Now let's work on from there. That was a bad choice. Because what it is it goes back to that false positive realm. And now we have to deal with remediating and trying to hide some of those frustrations from the developer. So we went after, we defined our own policy. So we looked at certain apps, whether it be a web app, a web service, right? If it's a web service that doesn't have cross-site scripting, there's no point in having those policies. Anyways, we did those tuning. Then we cared about what defects we cared about. We looked at the critical ones first. And then we talked about remediation. Now, this is the fun part, right? So once you have your source code, once you're scanning, we scanned every week, right? We produce these reports. And we, as the AppSec architects, tried to do our best to remove those false positives. We didn't want the developers to have any of these types of frustration. We wanted to go after true findings. So we moved it down to them. We provided ad hoc training for our developers. So you know, what is that cross-site scripting? What is SQL injection? What is command injection? What is path traversal? Right, you name it. There's so many different things. Until you really see it, you don't really know what it's about. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to go into my realm when I found my own SQL injection, my own products that I built 5 years ago. Right, didn't know what SQL injection was until I actually explored it, and I'm like, oh, that's not a good thing. So remediation training, everything, that's a big part that we need to come alongside. Metrics, reporting. You know, we capture a bunch of metrics. We do it every week. We bubble those up monthly to our executive team. We know how many lines of code you change. We know your defect to lines of code change. We know the defects of particular language, defects per products, communities, et cetera. So we have all this type of metrics. So we could see, are we getting better? And with this comes cost savings, right? If you can find the vulnerabilities early in the life cycle instead of at the end, the cost of fixing it is much cheaper. I'll just blast through that. We won't go into this for time's sake, but basically this is an open query and the ability for us to actually extend the tool we chose to look for certain things. This is actually looking for deprecated methods. I won't go into what deprecated method is, but it's basically not a good thing for manageability and maintainability of source code as you move forward. So it gets antiquated. This is sort of what one of our products is. This is trending in the right direction, right? We started with 11 defects. We got down to 2, which is great. But let's not kid ourselves, right? We still have practices we have to do. So this is just a good, realistic trend that one of the products is on. It's a good thing. We still have education to do. And then I provided some of these resources at the end. OWASP, very popular thing in the AppSec realm. They have the Application Security Verification Standard. They have the web goats, and they have, I forget what it's called, but broken web applications is basically a thing that, it's basically a GitHub repo that has a bunch of web goat type apps that you could put these types of products through. Sonar Cube, some of the open source stuff. Node security package, that's a big thing that we use at EP. It goes back to what I said when we pulled in 1,500 libraries, how do we scan it? This is a particular tool from Node that scans these types of packages looking for vulnerabilities. And then last but not least, ep.com/security. We produce white papers on all three of these talks. You can go to that URL. You can see a little bit more colorful language of our white papers, and that's all I got.
Thank you.
Yeah.
A bit of a whirlwind.